Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Autumn Wilkie, and I am a host with the New Books Network. Today, we're joined by Dr. Lindsay Perez-Huber and Dr. Susana Munoz, who will be discussing their new book, Why They Hate Us, How Racist Rhetoric Impacts Education, which was published in 2021. Dr. Lindsay Perez-Huber is a professor of education at California State University, Long Beach, as well as a visiting scholar at the UCLA Center for Critical Race Studies. Her research analyzes racial inequities in education, the impact on marginalized urban students of color, and how students in their communities respond to those inequities through strategies of resistance. Dr. Susana Munoz is an associate professor of education at Colorado State University. Her research focuses on issues of access, equity, and college persistence for undocumented Latina and Latino students. Lindsay and Susana, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your expertise with the listeners of the New Books Network. Can the two of you share a little bit about what led you to writing Why They Hate Us?
Sure. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. And I'm really excited to talk about our work and our book. I guess I'll start, if that's okay, Susana.
Go ahead. So
I think for what led to kind of this particular project was some work I had been doing previously around trying to theorize what was happening during the during Trump's presidential campaign several years before. And so just seeing patterns in the racist rhetoric that was being used in his campaign, Susana and I both have been trained in ethnic studies, and knowing that, you know, what we were seeing at that time around, you know, 2016 was not something new, and in fact was a historical pattern of racist rhetoric, of discourses of white supremacy being used to garner political support. And it was happening at a particular moment, right, following a Black president, right? And so really trying to understand what was going on during that time. I was using, a framework of racist nativism that we'll talk about later in the interview to understand this kind of anti-Latinx racism that was happening and wanting to know why it was happening at that particular moment. And so looking at those historical patterns, not only during the presidential campaign, but of course, once Trump was elected, and seeing how that racist rhetoric was then impacting the behaviors of his supporters was, I think, something that led to us, you know, working on this project and wanting to know as scholars in education, how this was impacting our students of color in particular, and communities of color, as it related to their educational experiences.
Yeah. So thanks for having me, Autumn. I think the only thing I would add was the fact that during that time, I was also thinking about sort of this notion of the Trump effect on our college campuses and thinking about how that impacts our campus climates. And so I've been in my own work engaging in sort of campus climate studies within my own state and thinking about how that impacts students' ways of navigating not only their campus climates, but in what ways are they perceived by their peers due to the campus climate. And so I felt like this was a really good opportunity to have a book that really looked at the educational pipeline from this perspective, and trying to also understand that this didn't start with Trump. This has been sort of a, you know, historical legacy of racist nativism, but we see lots of sort of like the residual effects or the impacts, the long-lasting impacts that it has had on the educational opportunities and access for, in particular, students of color and immigrants. And so I think this was a really good opportunity to sort of name it for what it was, and to really have these discussions from the educational pipeline perspective.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that introduction and really kind of bringing us into your process for thinking about this book. Dr. Perez Huber, you alluded to, you know, sort of some of the pieces around how racist nativism plays into this. And you open the book with an introduction that provides a history of racist rhetoric in the U.S., particularly as it's been used in political campaigns over the past several decades. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more about racist nativism and how it serves as a framework for analyzing this racist rhetoric?
Yeah, so racist nativism, I theorized along with my colleagues back in 2008-2009 to name something else we saw happening in the political sphere at that time, which was the introduction of a bill called H.R. 4437, which was an anti-immigrant bill, further criminalized undocumented communities, criminalized people who were supporting undocumented people and communities as well. And so what was happening during that time was here, at least in Los Angeles, where I was living, was the largest kind of mass mobilization in the history of our city, was a pro-immigrant rally to denounce H.R. 4437 that I participated in, along with some of the folks that I co-authored this piece with. And so really wanting to name the kind of virulent anti-Latinx racism that we were seeing during that time was where racist nativism came from. And so racist nativism helps us understand, again, the significance of history, that these are historical patterns. They're not, you know, kind of particular historical moments that stand alone, that they're connected to, like Susana said, these broader legacies of racism and white supremacy. And that it's also, I think another critical component of racist nativism is that this form of racism has targeted various groups of color, particularly immigrants of color, over time. And it is based on perceptions, right? It's based on white perceptions of who belongs and who doesn't in the United States. And so at the time when we were theorizing racist nativism, it really helped us get at that intersection of racism and nativism that we were seeing. And I think has been a concept that has helped us name those moments when we see those intersections playing out over time. And when, you know, we saw the rhetoric that Trump was using in his presidential campaign, the racism of his administration, it really was, I think, a helpful concept to help us name what was going on, both during, you know, before, during, and after his presidency, is that racist nativism is a concept that really gets to the way that folks are being targeted because of this perception that they do not belong here, right? And that their very presence is also a threat, right, to our white social structure. So, and I think Susana's also used it in some really important ways as well.
Yeah, so I think one of the things to think about, like, racist nativism is really how that notion has been, well, we talk about it in the book, these articulations of racist nativism that can be found in not only the supporter behavior, but also in the ways in which who's deserving and undeserving of certain rights and privileges in this country. And so I think that also connects to sort of that my chapter one in terms of the concept of whiteness as property, thinking about ways in which, we are on stolen lands, right? And so thinking about ways that whiteness and white dominance sort of gets infiltrated in the ways to maintain sort of white dominance. And so we see this articulated in, you know, in examples as like the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, you know, we will not be replaced, is connected to whiteness as property in terms of like who's you know, who gets to enjoy liberties and rights in this country, who gets to enjoy access, who gets to who has the right to prosper in this country. And white dominance and these racial hierarchies are certainly inform the ways in which this country dictates who gets to enjoy sort of these liberties that's rooted in white dominance. And so, and I think to Lindsay's point about sort of that this is super entrenched in the historical legacy of immigration. So if you think of the fact that like our immigration is based on white supremacy and is racist, inherently racist, we start to understand that these things are reproduced and perpetuated throughout history, not only in terms of like the acts and policies and the legislation that has been passed, but also in terms of in what ways has our educational systems, and in particular higher education, also emulated that behavior. Let's stop there.
Yeah. Well, and I know, Dr. Munoz, that a lot of your work, your other work, has focused on the experiences of undocumented students in higher education. And so I'm wondering if you could actually say even a little bit more about some of the ways that whiteness as property plays out in higher education for particularly undocumented students.
Yeah. So I think we have to understand that, it goes into these cycles, right? And so in the book, I use sort of the cycle of convergence, divergence, and reclamation to talk about sort of some policies that we see that, once we have passed like in-state tuition policies, that gives sort of just leveling out the playing field for undocumented and DACA students. We see some states as that immigrants are taking away from others. And so like the state of Texas every year, it feels like they're trying to take away that policy. So every year that becomes a very contentious issue in the state. And so, so we see it played out in sort of like our attempts to level out the playing field. I'm not even talking about the welcoming environment. I'm just talking about even just a bit of access, just, you know, trying to get at the door at this moment. And so we see that in our in-state tuition policies in terms of the state ideologies really dictate sort of in ways in which states decide who gets to enjoy those rights, who gets to keep those rights. And there's been states that have had certain, I'll take Arizona, for instance, had in-state tuition policies for DACA students that got taken away. So it's really dependent on the ideology of those states.
And, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think another place where we see this is in kind of when we think about this concept of reclamation from the CDR model, right? That And critical race theorists in the legal field have been talking about this for a long time. Whenever we see any movement, any positive movement made toward gaining more rights for undocumented students, undocumented communities, we're always going to see this pattern of retrenchment or reclamation, right, of those rights. And so I think for DACA and a lot of the tuition policies that we've had from state to state, students have been able to enjoy a little bit more access, right, or have gained a little bit more access to higher education. But now with this new Supreme Court, right, I think there really is some grave concern around the future of Plyler, right, and what that means for undocumented students and undocumented communities when we've seen, right, the rights of women kind of go out the door with the Supreme Court. It's kind of, you know, folks are asking, like, what's next, right? And I think that there's some really great concern to be had around the future, I think, of educational access for undocumented students and, like Susanna said, the type of climates, right, because of those kind of policy decisions are going to be made for undocumented students in higher ed and also in K-12 schools. And so that I think that's another way, right, that this idea of whiteness as property also plays out is that you know, the gains of people of color are temporary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think explaining that cycle of retrenchment is really valuable, and I think that several of the scholars who have chapters in the books kind of talk about pieces of that, and which kind of leads me to really asking some questions around since Why They Hate Us really features chapters from other scholars and is an edited volume. Can you talk a little bit about the process the two of you went through in terms of curating the edited volume and really thinking about what needed to be included within this book?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to ensure that it wasn't education wasn't talked about kind of in silos, that this was happening not just in higher education and not just in K-12 education. This racist rhetoric was violently impacting the lives of students across the pipeline. And so ensuring that we told the stories, right, of students in both levels, or I guess in all levels of higher education, because we actually tell K-12 stories, community college stories, and four-year stories in this book. So that was something important. And I think a couple of the folks that, you know, we both kind of brought folks that we had known and work that we were familiar with at the time. I think so my mentor, Danny Solorzano, who chaired my dissertation, who I continue to work with, has this course he teaches called the RAC, the Research Apprenticeship Course. We've actually gone to his RAC and presented this book as well in that space. It's become, I think, a really important space because it brings together scholars to talk about their work. It brings together students to talk about their work. And there's a few people that are included in this book that came to that RAC to present. Tanya is one of those students, well, now she's a professor, but formerly a student. Sylvia, now a professor, also a student at the time, were two folks whose presentations I had seen in that rack, in that space, and that became authors in this book.
Yeah, and the other thing that I would add to is that we didn't want, you know, this is not just like a Latino, Latinx issue, right? And so highlighting that this is really complex and that immigration and, you know, immigration policies really impact, you know, many individuals, you know, across race, across, you know, different other multiple identities. And so there is a chapter around sort of like refugee college students. And so particularly Muslim refugee Black students. And so we think about this issue in very intersectional ways and ways that we really need, that's sort of where we probably need to expand and move way more, is to think about sort of this like hate rhetoric, this racist rhetoric that it intersects with anti-Blackness, you know, sort of in the anti-Muslim regime. And so in thinking about immigrant and refugee students in ways that it's the legal status is also complex and complicated in many ways by these immigration policies. And so so I think that's where I think we also highlight some work by some scholars and students from Arizona State. But also I feel very deeply that that's where the work also needs to be, you know, taken forward as well. We don't talk enough about this intersectional ways of looking at these issues.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, and I think, you know, as I was reading all of the chapters too, one of the things that struck me, and I think you were both already alluding to this, is not just sort of the intersectional aspects around identity, but like how much it depends on where, like that it's not just federal policy, it's also state, and like really looking at some of the policies and legislature that's happening state by state, like thinking about the ways that, you know, sort of the our national conversation impacts what's happening at the state level, and sort of these microcosm things that are happening at the state level also impact sort of racist rhetoric nationally. And I think the Unite the Right rally, I think, you know, was sort of something that was happening nationally, but played out, you know, in a more geographical sort of region and then rippled back out nationally. And so I'm wondering if there are ways that you can talk about how, as you were sort of researching or as you were writing the book, the ways that some of those geographical differences were sort of impacting conversations in terms of how racist rhetoric was impacting immigrant students in different states. Does that make sense to the two of you?
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I would say is that I think we need to be really careful and cautious to think of like a state like California as this very progressive, very immigrant friendly state. I think there are very much pockets of resilience, pockets of radical hope, pockets of just organized community organizing that's happening. And I think that's what I see sort of like when we talk about specific states. I think it's important to keep in mind that white supremacy isn't necessarily contained in conservative states, right? It's very much everywhere across the nation. I think where I find the most hope is that even in those conservative states, there are mobilizing and organizing happening to support immigrants and support refugees. And so I think when we look at across the nation, you know, thinking about ways in which we're honest about naming it, right? Just because I live in Colorado and we have in-state tuition policies and we have a pretty progressive governor doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have white supremacists that live in our state and that aren't mobilizing themselves. So I think an honest conversation about the fact that we do have a white supremacist problem in all of our states, I think, is warranted in that aspect.
Yeah, like I think chapter four, there was a group who was working from, actually was working in the community of San Diego in California. And when we think about, right, just like Susana is saying, when we think about California, we think about Gavin Newsom and the very progressive, very democratic agenda. But that I think that story was so important because it gets exactly to what Susana just said, is it shows that, you know, in these communities, there's these pockets of our state. And in this particular study, it was interesting because it's also kind of it's close to the U.S.-Mexico border, right? And so there's these pockets of very conservative communities, and those patterns of racist nativism are playing out in those communities as well. And in this particular chapter, also talks about how white educators, right, deal, how white educators can support undocumented students, because the majority of our educators in K-12 are white. And so, you know, how do also white educators play a role in mitigating or, you know, supporting students in this very racist nativist climate was, another important contribution that was made from that chapter. And then John Rogers and Michael Ishimoto and their chapter was a national study, right? So looking at how school climates are being impacted across the nation, I think really provide evidence to what Susanna was just talking about, is that these patterns of racist nativism, of these very racist discourses are something that we see across the nation in our schools, and that are negatively impacting our students. So not just something happening in Arizona or in Louisiana or in Alabama, right? It's happening all over the state. And that's, I think, a great contribution they made, was to show this national pattern.
Yeah. Well, and I certainly think, kind of, you know, based on what both of you are saying, you know, we've seen over the last couple of years that white supremacists are also not reluctant to cross state lines, you know, to go to various places in order to sort of mobilize in really toxic ways against students and against immigrants. And, you know, the Reunite the Right, I think, was an example of that. January 6th, like all of these are sort of where a lot of the folks are coming from. I live in Iowa. You know, I think a lot of the folks who have done a lot of that traveling have been coming from the Midwest. And so thinking about that, you know, even if it is something that's happening in a particular region of our country, that's not necessarily where all of the that this is a national issue where white supremacy and sort of the re-entrenchment of, like, we need to reassert sort of pieces of this. And it is something that is happening sort of on that national level, regardless of where the sort of local piece is playing out.
That's right. And I wish, I guess I don't wish this, but I think about when January 6th happened, right? We had just, the book had just been published, right? So we didn't get a chance to talk about this in the book, but Susanna and I wrote a blog for Teachers College Press, the publisher, because it was just such it was just such a clear example of what this book was about, right? To see how racist nativism directly impacts the violent behaviors of Trump supporters and the threat to white dominance, to the structures of white supremacy, was just, I think, if I think about any kind of major event, probably no other event was as clear as that January 6th insurrection.
Yeah, we had a hard time concluding this book because just stuff kept happening, you know, and we talk about the, you know, the police violence against Black men. We talked about sort of what was happening with DACA and what was happening on our campus, you know, and how everyone all of a sudden became avowedly anti-racist at that moment, right? And so we wanted to also complicate, you know, what does this mean when, you know, Nike becomes anti-racist or McDonald's is their anti-racist? And so I think it's way more complex than these that sort of performative activism and rhetoric that we saw. You know, and the other component was that, you know, this goes back to another concept in the book that we talk about in chapter one around the great replacement theory, in terms of that's a historical concept that, you know, the right wing party has really latched onto in terms of the demographic changes that are happening in our country are certainly things that people are looking at in terms of whiteness, you know, and where and what whiteness and white dominance looks like. And so I think that is also an important contribution of this book, is that there's a lot of historical nuances that we kind of call out that is actually being used as political strategy in terms of the messaging around, you know, the question, who is deserving or undeserving to be in this country?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and I think that was one of the points that I think was made a couple times in the book, particularly in the intro and in chapter one, you know, that, you know, some of what you were saying at the beginning, Dr. Perez Huber, was around, you know, how you were watching sort of what was happening with Trump's campaign, but that none of the rhetoric Trump was using was necessarily new or his. And I think really coming back to that point that this has been a cycle, and you know, certainly I think you call out in the book in a couple of places that there was a greater visibility maybe with some of the things that were happening around the Trump campaign, but that was not, none of it was new language or new sort of tools for pushing forward this racist rhetoric. And so I'm wondering if either of you have anything that you would like to add sort of about some of that cycle that you sort of talked about, how this is language that we've seen come up over and over, or patterns that we've seen come up over and over in terms of some of that racist nativism and pieces of that.
So in the final chapter that Susanna was talking about, we called it the racism pandemic because of these multiple pandemics that we were dealing with. We were dealing with, of course, during the time we wrote, actually, I think this book was written entirely during the pandemic, right? During COVID. And so, you know, communities of color were suffering, were dying as we were writing this book. So there's the racist rhetoric, there is the kind of, you know, the ways that the pandemic had, you know, I'm losing the word, made worse. I'm trying to think of the good word for made worse, right? Made worse the conditions and lives of communities that have been historically marginalized, right? Who didn't have access, you know, to healthcare, who were essential workers, who had to be showing up and exposing themselves to, you know, getting sick. And so there was like this convergence of events that were happening that really just highlighted how dire the conditions were that white supremacy has created. And so when we look at these historical patterns, right, we understand that, yes, this isn't something new, but it also presented this opportunity to really think about what happens when these multiple kind of global events converge, right? When we see the activism of Black Lives Matter, you know, folks demanding for, you know, an end to police brutality, to murder of Black people, it was something I think we were trying to kind of work through that was also emotionally draining for us as we were also experiencing, you know, the effects of some of these events. And so I think that one thing that one concept that we talk about in this chapter was the Derrick Bell's theory of racial realism. And that is the theory that, you know, racism was, it is, and it always will be. It will always be a part of U.S. society. Racism will always be present in the ways that our social systems operate, in, you know, our daily interactions. And so then what? So knowing this, then what, right? So we know then that those patterns of racism, of racist nativism, are going to continue. But one thing that we talked about in the book was, you know, the hope that this activism brings us in thinking about how future generations then respond to those historical patterns. And I think one thing that's really hopeful for me, as I see, you know, Susanna and I are both parents, right? And we see our daughters. When I see my daughter, you know, who's going off to college, and I seek the type of critical analysis that she has as a young person, just beginning her college career, I mean, she's like so ahead of me, right? She's ahead of me in many ways where I am today. And just seeing kind of the critical consciousness that our youth already have, I think really brings a lot of hope. Their intentionality around self-care, their intentionality around the language they use, which was something when I was growing up that I had I was not anywhere close to that. That was something I learned, you know, as a college student, as a grad student. That's something I think that is hopeful in thinking about how future generations are going to respond to these patterns of racism, of white supremacy, of racist nativism.
I would totally echo that. I think I have a lot of hope in our youth. And I also, you know, think, I hope that our educational system becomes more emboldened to really highlight some of these societal issues as ways, you know, to educate our students. And I think I get disheartened with the whole critical race theory conversation that we've been having as a nation. And it's infuriating because it's being co-opted as something that it is not, right? And so I think for me, it's as someone that identifies a critical race color, it's, you know, it's being used as a tactic to silence individuals that are doing the work, that want to do the work, that want to really make our spaces in our educational system more humane for our students. You know, it's apparent to our youth what is happening in our country. They know it. I hope that we also have responsibility, or have institutions take the responsibility also to have those really challenging and difficult conversations, you know, in the classroom, you know, in our policies and the ways that we onboard faculty and staff and how we hire teachers. You know, this, what would I call racial literacy that we're needing to have these discussions to unpack what is happening in our society is what is going to be not only create nurturing spaces, but liberatory spaces for our students.
What are the two of you working on now? You know, whether that be together or separately, where is the next couple of years taking you?
Well, I'm going to be on sabbatical. So I'm going to take a year off to really just, you know, not focus on just my spirit and my soul and just replenishing that too, but also looking at, you know, more so community colleges and sort of that transfer process for DACA and undocumented students, but under the guise of what do we mean when we talk about servingness, and especially if it's a Hispanic serving institution. So really kind of, you know, disrupt or interrogate a little bit more about what institutions need to be doing in interrogating not only white supremacy, but also this notion of servingness and how we, you know, construct a transfer process. And I don't know, Lindsay, I know we need to probably work on another project together because I think this works out so well.
yes, definitely. I'm very excited about, you know, the future work that we'll do together. I think we've talked about this in other spaces. We didn't have some talk about it so much today, but you know, the piece that we don't often talk about, you know, working in collaboration to put projects like these together was such, you know, just an enjoyable experience, a healing experience working with Susana to, during a pandemic when you're completely isolated, stuck at home, be able to come on Zoom and talk to each other about, you know, about this project and about, you know, theorizing together and also writing about what was happening in the moment, right? Like we did in how we concluded the book was just, you know, such a joy for me. I learned so much from Susana and got so much out of this project just kind of personally. So, you know, I think, you know, continuing those relationships are so important in this work and the work that we do, because those are what sustain you, you know, in many ways. Something I'm working on right now is I'm looking at, you know, the kind of everyday ways that racism is experienced by folks of color with the concept of microaggressions. I'm looking at how faculty of color are experiencing racial microaggressions in a campus where there has been some intention in wanting to develop an anti-racist climate. Right, and an inclusive climate. And so we've looked at microaggressions in predominantly white spaces that we know are, you know, usually hostile to faculty of color. But because there's this push now, like Susana mentioned, of institutions, you know, becoming anti-racist and making statements about anti-blackness, what does that mean for the ways that folks of color in those campuses experience racism? Does it change? And so that's one thing that I'm looking at right now. And also kind of turning to you know, experiences of healing is looking at micro affirmations. So I'm also working on a study looking at experiences of students of color, of graduate students of color, with racial micro affirmations. So the everyday ways that we validate and acknowledge the humanity of people of color that that sustain us, that allow us to thrive, that heal. And so that's another project that I'm working on.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for spending some time with us today. And for everybody who is listening as a listener of the New Books Network, if you haven't already read Why They Hate Us, I highly recommend going out and getting a copy of the book. This conversation today just touches on some of the many, many important points that are made throughout the book. And so I highly recommend that folks check out the book and spend some time not only listening to this podcast, but also reading and thinking more deeply about these issues. Thank you.
Thank you.